This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Today, I would like to present you some results of a research that I made in a recent time, a research on the figure of Alexander Kozhev. First of all, some biographical information on Kozhev, just as a reminder. Kozhev was born in the year 1901 in Moscow as Alexander Kozhevnikov. His family was rich, politically well-connected, and culturally aware. The family owned diamond copies in Siberia. It was really a very wealthy family. An important detail of his biography, he was a nephew of Vasily Kandinsky. He was sentenced to death for trying to sell diamonds on the Moscow black market in 1919, but released, probably through intervention of Kandinsky, who was pretty influential at that time. And after his release, Kozhev left the Soviet Russia in the same year, 1919, for Germany, where he kept himself afloat by doing business and at the same time studied philosophy. In the year 1926, he got a doctorate grade in philosophy at the University of Heidelberg under the direction of Karl Jaspers. But only after his immigration to France in the year 1933, Kozhev started his own philosophical discourse on the end of history and post-histoire that in many ways influenced our contemporary thinking, especially the whole discourse on postmodernity. The discourse was developed by Kozhev in the framework of the seminar on Hegel's Phenomenology of the Spirit that was given by him at the École des Solitudes in Paris between the years of 1933 and 1939. This seminar was regularly attended by leading figures of the French intellectual life of that time, like Georges Bataille, Jacques Lacan, to his most dedicated students, and Kozhev had a lifelong influence on them, André Breton, Maurice Merleau-Ponty, Raymond Aron. The transcripts of Kozhev's lectures circulate in the Parisian intellectual circles and were widely read there, also by Sartre and Camus. Of course, the discourse on the impending end of history is not new, but Kozhev asserted that the end of history does not wait for us in the future, but it was already doesn't pay for us in the future as it was usually thought. Rather, the end of history already took place in the past, namely during the Napoleonic War, as it was certified by the Hegelian philosophy. According to Kozhev, we live already for a pretty long time after the end of history under the post-historical condition that we simply not fully aware of this condition yet. This transfer of the end of history from the future into the past was in use at the time when Kozhev tried to make it plausible to his audience. However, Kozhev always asserted that he never tried to say anything new because saying anything new has become impossible after the end of history. He pretended to simply repeat, reproduce the text of Hegel's Phenomenology of the Spirit without adding anything to it. But of course, to repeat in under the different circumstances and in a different context. So it was a kind of an early case of postmodern strategy. During his lifetime, Kozhev never published any of his philosophical writings beyond some short articles. His course on Hegel that was published after the World War II in 1947 under the title Introduction Lecture de Hegel is a pretty loose patchwork of text and notes written by Kozhev himself and of transcripts made by different members of the audience. This collection of heterogeneous text fragments was produced not by Kozhev himself, but by surrealist writer Raymond Queneau. After the war, Kozhev abandoned philosophy altogether because the philosophies after the end of history made for him no sense anymore. Instead, Kozhev entered a diplomatic bureaucratic career. As a representative of France in the European Commission, Kozhev became one of the creators of the contemporary European Union. He worked out an agreement on the tariffs that remains until today one of the pillars of the European economic system. At the same time, Kozhev always stated that he was a Stalinist and that he believed that the post-histoire actually began with the death of Stalin. So he kind of moved it from Napoleon to Stalin. He moved it even further, actually, later. So let us discuss why Stalin plays such a central role in Kozhevian thinking. My presentation will focus on the two very different documents that can be found at the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris. The first document is a manuscript of about 1,000 pages, handwritten in Russian, that was produced by Kozhev in the years 1940-1941 in the occupied Paris. So between the entering of the German forces to Paris and begin of the German invasion into the Soviet Union. This manuscript was given by Kozhev to Georges Bataille before Kozhev left Paris after the German invasion of the Soviet Union. Another, probably machine-written, copy of the same text was given by Kozhev to the Soviet embassy in France to be sent to Moscow. And he attached to this text a personal letter to Stalin. The content of this letter is unknown. But obviously, Kozhev thought at that time about the possibility of his return to the Soviet Union. Because living under the German occupation became for him more and more difficult. But this copy was probably burned. The Soviet embassy was put on fire next day after the German attack on the Soviet Union, and everything that was inside it burned out. So this manuscript is the only existing lengthy and systematic presentation of Kozhev's philosophical thinking written by Kozhev himself, actually absolutely unique in the sense. But the manuscript remained unpublished and even not transcribed until now. It exists only in a Kozhev's difficult handwriting. Today I will present the most interesting aspects of it, interesting, of course, from my point of view. The second document is a collection of photographs made by Kozhev during his diplomatic career, so late 50s, beginning of the 60s. This collection was also never shown before, exists only in form of slides, so only in one copy. I will draw your attention to this story at the end of my lecture. There are around 5,000 photographs there, also a collection of postcards, around 10,000 postcards that he collected on his travel. I have organized digitalization of some of them, around 600, and projections and the installation or exhibition of the projections of the slides. And this exhibition was shown in different places, including Utrecht, South Korea, China, Paris, Palais Tokyo, and New York, James Gallery. But let me begin by speaking about the manuscript. This manuscript has a title, Sophia, Philosophia, и Phenomenologia. So, Sophia, Philosophy, and Phenomenology. The central part of the manuscript is dedicated to the analysis of the Soviet ideology. It is this analysis that I would like to attract your attention to in the first place. But I will also refer to Kozhev's comments on Freud and Heidegger, because in everything that was published by Kashef, you don't find the direct references to these authors. The influence of these authors is felt throughout Kashef's work, but at least to my knowledge, only this manuscript, the direct and lengthy characterization of this author by Kashef, can be found. Now let me turn to the part of the manuscript that addresses the Soviet ideology. It is a part of the introduction that has a subtitle, The Perfect or Absolute Knowledge of the Ideal of Awareness, Сознательность. So I translated сознательность as awareness. Kashef begins his analysis of the Soviet ideology by stating that the predicate сознательный, so conscious, aware, emerged and became widespread in Russian language as an immediate effect of the socialist revolution in Russia. Kashef cites popular formula like сознательный пролетарий, conscious proletarian, сознательный гражданин, conscious citizen, etc. And Kashef writes, from the perspective of Marxism, Leninism, Stalinism, he actually always writes in this form, Marxism, Leninism, Stalinism, self-awareness, сознательность, is the ideal for the whole mankind. As an example of such a self-awareness, Kashef describes a worker who buys a bottle of vodka and as he is asked why he did it, says that he just wanted to buy it because he wants to get drunk. In other words, the несознательный, so not self-conscious worker, sees his immediate desire to drink vodka as the ultimate source of his action. Whereas a сознательный, self-aware worker, can analyze the social context of his action, production and distribution of vodka, role of money, social culture conventions regulating the general consumption of vodka, use of vodka for the exploitation of working class, etc. A transition from the несознательный, not awareness, to сознательный awareness is a transition, he says, from the animal desire to drink vodka, to logos. It's interesting that he doesn't exclude and actually means that сознательный рабочий, so self-aware worker, also would drink vodka. But he would drink vodka knowing the true reasons for that. So it will be like a result of a long discussion with himself, a philosophical discussion, basically, yeah, about the true nature of his desire. And if at the end of this discussion he decides to drink this bottle of vodka, then it's okay. So social manifestation, and also internal manifestation, philosophical manifestation, logos, is conversation, discussion, social discussion, or discussion of the subject with itself. That is why the socialism is based on discussion and conversation, so not the market, yeah? On the permanent discursive analysis of all aspects of the social life. Kashef writes, сознательный self-aware worker, in a sense in which the Soviet ideology tries to create him, is actually a philosopher. So Kashef means that the scientific communism of Marx, Lenin, Stalin is an attempt to expand the philosophical project. He speaks about Socratic, Platonic, Aristotelian, Greek philosophical project, ancient Greek philosophical project, to its ultimate historical and social borders. So he understands the beginnings of European philosophy as the beginning of desire to know the reasons of one's own behavior. Yeah, know yourself. Yeah. And at the same time, self-understanding that includes all the context of one's existence. So he believes that this program that was formulated by Plato actually realized in the Soviet Union. So here Kashef stresses the atheist character of Marxism, Leninism, Stalinism that does not wait for the second coming of Christ at the end of the historical development and does not accept, and it's his, the so-called sacred human rights. Two main parts of the manuscript are titled Non-Human Presuppositions of Human Existence and Second Human Existence. The second part repeats in its main aspect the content of the Kajevian lectures on the phenomenology of Hegel, even if in a much more detailed form, and includes a very interesting phenomenology of the bourgeois form of existence. There are long chapters like The Best Friend or Family Dinner, as a phenomenological aspect of bourgeois form of life. Here I have not enough time to go into these details, and instead will concentrate myself on the two main fragments, on the first part that are dedicated to the analysis of Freud and Heidegger in the relationship to Hegel and Marx. Freudian psychoanalysis is discussed in the section under the title Discussion of the Marxist Critique of Ideology and Freud's Psychoanalysis. Kajev states that both Marx and Freud practice the critique of society and ideology in the name of the animal desires, such as hunger, a sexual desire, which have private, intimate character. They put the human animal and its animal needs in the center of the human existence and analyze political cultural formations as manifestation of the animal in man. On the first glance, he says, one can see in this strategy a program of return from humanity to animality, victory of the animal needs over the human aspirations. But Kajev asserts that such analysis overlooks a non-traditional treatment that the human animal gets through Marx and Freud's discourses. Here the unity of the human species becomes radically dissolved. The individual human animal ceases to be a representative of the species. Marxism understands the economic class interest as being very specific and conflicting ones. One can say that every human group and even every individual have specific and incompatible economic interests. For Freud, sexual desire always takes a very individual turn, depending on the specific biography of the psychoanalyzed individual. So for Kajev, Marxism and psychoanalysis lead to the radical fragmentation of society and ultimately individualization of the human beings on the most fundamental animal level of their existence. This analysis of the animal in man, so post-Freudian and post-Marxist animal in man, is important for the correct understanding of Kajev's famous constatation of the return of the humans to the animal mode of existence after the end of history, that's so much discussed by Agamben, for example. Heidegger is discussed by Kajev in the framework of his discussion of death. Kajev says that Heidegger is the only one important bourgeois philosopher of his time because he thematized the death and finality of human existence. But on the other hand, according to Kajev, Heidegger ignores the phenomenological horizon in which the subject opens itself to the possibility of its own death, understood as a total disappearance of everything. Of course, Heidegger practices phenomenological analysis of the opening to the possibility of the radical nothingness as accessible through experience of anxiety or later radical boredom. But speaking about phenomenology, Kajev means Hegelian and not Husserlian type of the phenomenological analysis. Accordingly, he believes that death shows itself as a possibility of human existence only through the experience of the revolutionary struggle, the struggle for life and death. So only if I put myself at risk, my own existence at risk, consciously, in a revolutionary struggle, I can discover myself as myself. For him, a typical ironic way, Kajev says that Heidegger took from Hegel death without revolution, and the Western Marxism took the idea of revolution without death. This very acute observation helps to explain where the later attempts to combine a certain kind of Western Marxism with a certain kind of Heideggerian philosophy originated. Here Kajev reinstated a position that was always at the core of his thinking. For Kashef, every true philosophy originates through revolution and war, and particularly through terror, but in any case, through peace and reflection. Kashef understands philosophy as a search for self-knowledge. This search is started by the emergence of self-consciousness. In its turn, the self-consciousness is an effect of the fear of death that the subject experiences under the condition of war or revolution. The fear of death is a question, the universal terror is the answer. The terror manifests the fact that death is our true master, and at the same time, our true nature. This analysis can be already found in Hegel's Phenomenology of the Spirit, where he speaks about the French Revolution. Hegel says that universal freedom can mean only universal destruction and death. That is why, he says, every creative activity is specialized. So if I do something, so to say, affirmative or positive, I do something special. Even if my efforts are included in some kind of general plan, this inclusion is not experienced immediately, Hegel says. It's only kind of abstraction. So if I do want to experience immediate universalization of my individual freedom, I have to participate in universal destruction. And at the end of this passage about French Revolution, Hegel famously writes, the death as a revolutionary death, it is the coldest and meanest of all the deaths, with no more significance than cutting off the head of the cabbage, of course, meaning the guillotine. So due to the revolutionary terror, the subject discovers its true nature. The subjectivity is nothingness, pure negativity. The only possible manifestation of the human subjectivity is death and destruction. Individual as killer, yeah? Kashef agrees with Hegel. In terror, the philosopher gets the answer to the question about the true nature of subjectivity, including his own subjectivity. And the philosopher becomes satisfied with this answer. So he abandons his question, his search for the self-knowledge, he abandons his desire for truth and desire to be loved by truth, and also desire to be desired and loved in general. This figure of desire and love is very much in the center of Kashefian thought. Not accidentally, he was so popular, especially among the French surrealists. And this topic of desire very much differentiates him from Hegel, because Hegel doesn't have in Phenomenology of Spirit the development of this. It's interesting that the French desire, yeah, is then translated back into German by the New World, by a New World, Das Begehren, yeah. That didn't exist before. So Kashef started his philosophical career, as I said already, by writing a dissertation on the work of Vladimir Solovyov, who was the most prominent and influential Russian religious philosopher at the end of the 19th century. He wrote this dissertation in Heidelberg in 1926. Now, in his writing, Solovyov thematized primarily the erotic dimension of philosophy that he understands as love for Sophia. And that's why Sophia, philosophia. So philosophia is understood by Solovyov as erotic desire to be loved by Sophia. Okay, by knowledge. So knowledge is understood by him as a female figure, as a female hypostasis of God. And actually, Solovyov believed that Sophia fell in love with him. It's a very famous story in the Russian cultural history. She began to write letters to him and gave him three erotic meetings, one in Egypt, two in Russia, and he described that meetings in some of his poetry. She was also very interested in his well-being, writing him, for example, that when he goes out of the apartment, he has to put some warm clothes, you know, because it's very cold, and so on and so on. And it's very interesting that the whole exchange of letters in the French, and Sophia signed Sophie. So, and playing with that, Khrushchev develops his theory of desire, differentiating between two types of desire. One type of desire is animal desire, is begierde, is animal desire. That means desire that destroys the object and consumes the object of desire. So if I, for example, want to drink something or to eat something, I destroy the object, yeah, by assimilation of it. And then a so-called anthropogenic desire. Anthropogenic desire is a desire to be desired, so self-reflexive desire. It is precisely this figure of self-reflexive desire or desire to be desired that so much impressed people like Bataille, Lacan, and so on, one can find everywhere. Reminiscences of that, or direct translations. And this kind of desire to be desired has different levels. One level, of course, desire to be loved, yeah, erotically loved. But one, maybe even more important aspect of that for Khrushchev is to be loved by the society, to be successful, to be admired, to be decorated like a war hero, revolutionary hero, to get glory, fame, yeah, all that. So that is, for Khrushchev, the goal of historical action. As this historical action translates into the economy of the individual philosopher's psyche. So I act in the society and through the society, in the body of society, to be loved by society, to eroticize the social space, yeah, to create a feeling of admiration, to create an effect of fame, yeah, and recognition inside the social body. So it's not like a class war. Yeah, it's very unlike the class war. It is a completely different, very much sexualized and eroticized relationship between individual and society. But then, what happens with a philosopher when he has a feeling that his desire for recognition is satisfied? He knows himself and the society loves him. That happened to Napoleon, yeah? Society began to love him. That happened to Stalin, yeah? And then he said later, that happened to Mao, yeah? We have this kind of coming to the end of desire for being desired by society. I am desired by society. I know that. What is after that? So what's interesting for him is the day after. Yeah. And the day after is pretty depressive. So the society of realized, recognized love, the society after the revolution, understood as a kind of sexual, erotic experience on the social level, this post-revolutionary, post-utopian, post-historical society is society without love, and without even possibility of love, and without even a possibility of desire, as anthropogenic desire, simply because it's society after love. Yeah? It's society after love found its ultimate consummation and then disappears. So the new post-historical humanity is humanity after love and beyond love, being able to have only animal desires and not anthropogenic desires. So he believes that after the end of history, we cease to be human and begin to be human animal. Spirit disappears, only bodies remain. And our desires are only physical desires, as desires dictated by our body function and not by our drive or desire of recognition and fame, desire of desire. So what happens to philosopher? Krajev says, philosopher became a sage. And who is a sage? Sage is somebody who doesn't need love and administers the society as a universal homogeneous society after the end of history. The only service for the sage remains possible is to tell and retell the love story between philosophy and society. Because Krajev says that actually mankind forgets the story. Mankind forgets the story that connects it to philosophy, and the sage reminds society of the story. But it is a past romance. Does the service still ask for the sacrifice? Theoretically not. Krajev says time and again that the time for sacrifice is over, the sage administers the society, but does not sacrifice himself to the society and does not seek its love. The only possibility for a human being to become different from an animal is a senseless act of sacrifice that imitates love, not to be inspired by love. And he says that is art. Yeah? He defines art as a way of self-sacrifice for a pure form, for something that is socially, historically, and politically irrelevant. As I organized this exhibition in New York, a guy came to me, he was pretty old, and he said, you know, I was one of the lecturers of Krajev, and the students asked him what we should do after the end of history, and he said something that was understood, like to become an artist and to commit suicide. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, why? Yeah, he said, what? Why become artist, commit suicide? I mean, after that, yeah, no. I mean, becoming artist is commit suicide. Yeah, and that this idea is to find to be found also in his early writings. If you attentively read his introduction, he already says time and again something that very much reminds one of Derrida, that writing in itself is a form of suicide and of the authors and so on. So Krajev, at the end of his life, creates something like a choice for a post-historical man to become an animal or to become an artist. To become an animal does mean to satisfy animal desires. To become an artist is to act against your own desires, to do something that makes, by definition, makes no sense. That is to die for a pure form. It's interesting that Kozhev died from a heart attack during a meeting of the European Commission in 1968. And in fact, there is even a tape, yeah, that fixed the moment of his death. So he's, lecturing about some kind of laws and whatever. And he makes like, oh, and he's dead. Yeah. And so it fixed. Yeah. So it is, of course, a truly romantic death. Yeah. One can say that Kozhev was a kind of Arthur Rimbaud of modern bureaucracy. A philosophical writer who consciously became a martyr of the post-historical bureaucratic order. So he couldn't live in a way in a world without love. But it's interesting that he died in 1968, so precisely at the moment before the beginning of kind of new cycle of, I don't know, imagination that wanted power and so on and so on. Now, at the end of this lecture, I will show you some images. As I said, these images are made by, by Kozhev. During his travels throughout the world, there's only one country that he visited many times and lectured here in the USA, but he never photographed it. You will see why. Actually, very unfavorably, he spoke about the American way of life as being purely animal without any chance to become artistic. Yeah. So, what can be found also in his collection of postcards, it is a description of his travels. You see from Paris to Tokyo, and then from Asia back to Europe, and then USSR. And interesting that he writes in Cyrillic, everything that has to do with Russia. Varsovie is by Latin characters, like Stockholm. And he writes he doesn't comment. It's very formal. It's only names of the cities from time to time, what kind of vessel he took from time to time, day of departure, day of arrival. And that is also a collection, part of collection of his postcards. The collection consists of two parts. You have the postcards, like a tourist postcard, and you have also postcards that relate to art history. He actually liked only Roman churches and modernist art. So you have, if you look at French, France, it's a huge collection of Roman churches, and after that, a lot of Matisse, a lot of Picasso, but nothing in between. An example of his own photographs of France. No people, only historical monuments. Nothing contemporary. Post-historical perspective on the dead history. A certain change These images in China, people were completely enchanted because there is not a lot of images from that time, as the time of earlier cultural revolution. And of course, what was interesting for him was this combination of the ancient Chinese monuments and revolutionary communist propaganda. Yeah? So this very famous revolutionary Dazibao, yeah? These walls where Red Brigades manifested the requirements. You see also this pagoda with communist slogan. Later, all of them were destroyed, so in the second phase of Cultural Revolution. And I found this very successful, yeah, because you have this kind of, suddenly you go into red, yeah, but it's imperial red, of course. Quite different is India. White, not red. Nepal. And Japan. He loved Japan and believed that Japanese are one of the few people or nations on the earth capable to die for nothingness. And of course, Russia. Yeah? Russia looks a bit as India. And you see also this, only old churches. He was a militant atheist, but you will see only churches and a kind of, I don't know, mass of earth, yeah? Chaotic mass of earth. A residence of the patriarch. Also, everything in white, yeah, nothing red. I think it can be the end, yeah. So as I saw these images, there are two aspects that seemed interesting for me. First of all, he, in a very Hegelian way, he tried to make his own perspective on the image like neutral, public, mass-produced perspective. So he wanted that his own view coincides with a public view. In a certain way, his images are the images of the mass postcard mass production of that time. He collected his postcards just to train his view, train his gaze in a way that he would look at the things in a kind of public mass acceptable way. So even if it's strange to say at the first glance, it's not very far away from Andy Warhol, yeah, and other artists of the same time. How far he went in this direction, if we look at the collections of his archive at the Bibliothèque Nationale, there's a secret part of it, it's erotic photographs made by him. And it's very interesting that he made erotic photographs in the same way. He made cuttings from magazines and newspapers, more or less erotic, and then invited models to take the same positions as in the newspaper's image and photographed them, yeah. So for him, what for him was interesting is a kind of public eroticism, yeah. The understanding, he was interested in how people look at certain phenomena much more than how he makes his own choices. And the second point is a certain kind of homology between the position of post-historical Hegelian and our contemporary position of the globalized tourist. Just to illustrate what I want to say is a small history from my German, so to say. A friend of mine organized an excursion to China, and they were brought to a huge statue of Buddha, and the guy told them it is the biggest statue of Buddha in China. And then they asked, yeah, how many centuries this statue stays here? And the guy said, it was brought yesterday, actually. So if you come to certain, as a tourist, if you come to certain place, you are not participating in the history of this place. Your gaze cut into this history and knows only past and present. There are no future. So you have only past and present as two possible times. And everything that happened in the past happened simultaneously in a certain way. And everything that happens now also happens simultaneously. It is a principle of contemporary tourism. It is a principle of the Hegelian philosophy. After you read Hegel says at the end of writing of Phenomenology of Spirit, he is sitting alone in his room, and all the spirits at the same time coming from the past and fill the space he is sitting in at the same time. Yeah, this kind of making history simultaneous and making history a simultaneous past, in a complicated relationship to the present. Present is nothing else as a outside position, a capability, ability for the subject to contemplate this simultaneous past. Yeah? It is the same international tourism, and the same the Google. Google is also a machine, like Phenomenology of Spirit by Hegel. Google is a machine of turning history into the past. Yeah? If you look at Google, everything that is already there, it's something that already happened, and happened at the same time. Yeah, you actually get the whole list at the same time what happened before. So you have this kind of, I think his photographs illustrate a certain connection between globalization that already is felt in the Hegelian project and a certain kind of thinking of end of history and a certain kind of imagining the place in a globalized way beyond history, history as an object, history as a past. Okay. That is what I want to say.
It's on? Okay, thank you. Now we have time for some questions. You will be the first. Excellent.
I just have a quick question about the first part of your talk, and I was wondering if you could draw a connection. So if in the Soviet Union every citizen is a philosopher, then the self-destruction for the sake of form became massified. Would that be the implication? And so, in fact, the entire... I think you're saying that the philosopher destroys himself for the sake of creating desire. So is that a mass society of self-destruction?
Well, he speaks not only about the Soviet Union, he speaks about the whole world, yeah. He speaks explicitly that he doesn't see any specific difference between American Revolution, French Revolution, October Revolution, Fascist Revolution in Italy, Nazi Revolution in Germany, cultural revolution in China. All these revolutions have the same function in the life of the nations. They make a cut, separate the present from the history, and create something like a new beginning. Yeah, they destroy everything that is historical, that has its legitimation, its roots in history. They create an effect of terror. They create an effect of fear, some kind of fear of trembling. Yeah, that, as he says, dissolves everything that was. Yeah, everything evaporates and dissolves and evaporates. And so there is a possibility of a new beginning. It is simply so that different nations went through this experience at different times.
Yes, I was wondering if you went to the movies, because this desire to be desired, I mean, what might be the relationship between this notion of the desire to be desired and the rise of stardom in mass culture in at the very moment that he's theorizing?
Yes, it is obvious, yeah, that for him it was mass culture was a way to satisfy this desire to be desired in a way that is post-historical, that does not anymore change the course of history. Yeah, he speaks about history as a period in which achievement and success coincide. Yeah, in one of his later texts, and he said that in our time, achievement and success are separated. So he said, I prefer achievement, but other people prefer success. They prefer fame, yeah, and admiration. But this fame and admiration are not of the sort that can really change the life of the societies. Yeah, it's not like you admire, I don't know, Che Guevara, yeah? And this kind of admiration can change the life of society, can change the life of Cuba, for example. Yeah? But in the states like the USA, or Russia, or France, somebody can be very popular, yeah, but this popularity doesn't change the texture of society and the course on which the society took, yeah, and goes from.
Hi, thank you so much for that. I am, of course, particularly interested in this idea of becoming an artist as a form of suicide. And I guess my question is more a request for you to expand a little bit on that point in particular. But I guess, excuse me, if the post-historical man can either become an animal, which is to satisfy animal desires, or become an artist, which is going against these desires by creating something without purpose, is that correct? Yeah. Then it seems to me that that is the more human choice, rather than satisfying animal desires. But creating without purpose seems inherently human somehow to me. So I'm interested in hearing more on this idea of the connection to suicide, if it's the end of self, the end of humanness contained in the idea of the artist. Can you speak a little bit more to that?
Yeah, I think that his thinking is very much Nietzsche and Freudian. Yeah. So it's about asceticism, yeah, as a way to suppress the immediate gratification of your desires for the goal of realizing a certain kind of plan. Yeah? So if you live in a historical, under the historical condition, you suppress your gratification of your immediate desires, of your body desires, to be able to get through something like industrialization, yeah, October Revolution, because all these practices are in one way another ascetic practices. Yeah. But if you are post-historical, you are in a strange situation of somebody like James Joyce. Yeah. So you're unhappy, you are armed, you are poor. You can't satisfy your immediate desires. What you do, you write a novel. Yeah. And you write a novel 10 years, and maybe 20 years, maybe 30 years, yeah, and maybe whole life, yeah. And this whole life, you suppress yourself, you process your desires, yeah. That is a suicide. That's a long form of suicide. Yes, suicide means simply you take yourself out of life to dedicate your existence to creating of what, not to creating something historically substantial, yeah, but creating a form. Yeah, Ulysses is a form. Yeah, this is a novel. And of course, you create a kind of fame, yeah, and admiration, at least in American Academy, yeah, for the sort of British American Academy. But the question is it worth? Yeah, for it. Yeah, so he admired that. So he admired that because he was not able. That, yeah, he thought that other people are. For example, he said, my uncle is like that. Yeah? So Vasily Kandinsky could really sacrifice himself in pure form, but he was not capable to do it.
Thank you. That was an interesting answer. I want to come back a little bit to the idea of mass culture and the idea of the admiration that the individual seeks through achievement and the desire for recognition. So you began by saying that Kojève thought of himself as a Stalinist, and then Stalin represents one of the moments of the end of history. So does Stalin's own cult of fame and recognition, how does that play in, you know, his manipulation of mass media? Is it because it's false, or I don't know, just how does it, in what sense is he a Stalinist, and how does it refer to this?
Because we know that Stalin was a very ascetic figure, never enjoyed himself in a certain way, had no property. All the things he used had numbers. After he died, people who actually searched his places saw that everything had a number of a property of Central Committee. He had no private property. He was admired for that, and he was successful, and he produced some achievement. I think what his death in 1968 is really very important, because I think that the mass culture, as we understand it, emerged at that year. I think that before 1968, we didn't have mass culture. We did have a culture for the intellectuals, yeah? And we had the societies of work. Yeah? So the idea of mass consumption and mass culture was maybe began to be developed in America at that time, yeah, but it was not recognized as such in Europe. Yeah, even in his late writings, Freud says that my psychoanalysis is not for artists and intellectuals, because it's a practice culture, and culture is a sublimation, and so they don't need psychoanalysis. Only people that do not practice culture do need psychoanalysis, but these people are absolute majority of the society. So we live in a completely different time. We live in a time when we have, of course, this rock concert where all the people make like that, yeah? And so we don't need any Nazi movement. Yeah, we have it already on our stadiums and football plays and a rock concert. After 68, we created huge industry of sublimation and channeling. of erotic energies of the masses. Yeah, so to neutralize them and not to create what La Palma did, yeah? what Bataille said, repressed part, yeah, of the social life. Yeah, so repressed energy, yeah? Not used, unused energy that can destroy society. There's no such a thing here, yeah, in our society. But it's something that Kashev couldn't see. Yeah? He couldn't see the mass phenomenon of channeling the erotic energy on a big scale. Yeah, that simply didn't exist. It was not a part of his philosophical reflection at that moment. Yeah, but you know, movies, yeah, it was still movies like, you know, it's not like Hollywood movies today, yeah? It's not like, for example, Hollywood movies that create something like, I don't know, Carl Schmitt situation of State of Exception, some kind of satellite comes and the Earth explodes, yeah, and aliens come, the whole humanity unites, yeah. You have sacrifice, you have all, in every American movie, big American movie, is the whole human history, whole Hegelian phenomenology of spirit, yeah, from the beginning, yeah, some kind of conflict between me and the other, struggle for life and death. And then I win the struggle, maybe I die, maybe not, yeah, but everybody is happy to see me and my girl kiss me, I know. So you have, that is a phenomenology of spirit, yeah? I do all that and my girl kiss me, yeah? That's American movie. After that, I have nothing to do, yeah? So after that, I have to commit suicide. But it is suicide because she already kissed me, yeah? So then you have end, yeah? That is end of the movie. Then come next movie, next movie, next movie. And every next movie is the next knowledge of the spirit. So you have this eternal recycling, yeah, of the same story.
Yeah, I would be interested in your relationship to Kursheev in terms of post-historical, because at the very end of your lecture you seem to, you know, homogenize in a way the two perspectives and making it able to apply it to contemporary culture and discussions now. But obviously what you are doing is a classically very nice historical presentation, which would not make sense within Kursheev's own terms. Yeah? And I would be very, because I what can we, isn't the, you know, problem in any, you know, post-historical assumption, in the moment you make it, you are part of history again, and there's a, you know, performative contradiction probably in that, or the dependence of a post-historical argument on real historical events, be it Napoleon, Stalin, or mass culture, or something like that. And so I would be very interested what that history means, and maybe not to homogenize it, but more insist what you would say in the differences between, you know, this historically modernist project and your own one.
My goal was really to present a certain way of thinking here. What I think myself about it are many different things. Yeah, you know, I think many different things. First of all, if I'm a sage, if I'm a Hegel, if I'm Kashev, I believe, at least as an exceptional case in humanity, to have some kind of memory, maybe that is maybe not quite absolute memory, but not very far from divine memory. Yeah. I have this memory of the past in its entirety. I know how I came to the situation as it is. Yeah. I think we have good reasons to be skeptical about that. Yeah? That point number two. Point number one. Point number two is that the universal homogeneous state, as it was described by Kajev, is a project in itself. He believes that he was realized in America, in the Soviet Union, in Western Europe. And he also believed that this is a model that was found and that will be spreading all over the world in a certain way. It was, of course, not a model. It's like more social democratic and maybe even communist model. Then, because it's a model, it's a state model, basically. Yeah? It's a state-regulated model. It's not, of course, a model of Francis Fukuyama. Yeah? So it's not democratic. His ideal was European Union, yeah? So perfect administration. So it's not Fukuyama, it's not democratic, it's not about the markets. It's about a kind of social state, yeah. Let's say global social state. The question is, are we really going into this direction, or are we going in opposite direction? Second question is, to what degree it is in itself a product of social imagination? For example, being a curator in a different curatorial projects, I see international, so-called international curator as a typical bureaucrat of non-existing state, yeah, because, yeah. So, in a certain way, it is bureaucracy of the imaginary, yeah, that he creates it. But I think if you to direct say to what you said, I think we all are in post-historical situation. We all are in a post-historical situation, and he has right in this one aspect. But this post-historical situation is structured in the following way. History ended yesterday. Not in Napoleonic time, not in Stalin death, but yesterday. And if you look everything that is written and became popular in the last decades, everything is structured on this base. Like, before internet, it was one thing. After internet, everything changed. Yeah? Before Google, everything was like that. After Google, everything became different. Before Ukraine, Krim was occupied, everything was like that. Now everything became completely different. So the structure of thinking in terms of post-histoire that was introduced by Hegel and codified by Kajev, I think became a mass cultural practice. But this means that the structure itself is not connected to any specific event. It is free-floating structure that can be connected to any event whatsoever. Only important that I know what happened, I know what happened is essential, I got it, and that is what allows me to speak now and speak the truth. Yeah? This kind of claim is deeply ingrained in the inner ways how our culture functions, and they say, how I react to it, I just look at it and enjoy it.
Hi, I really enjoyed the lecture too. I'd like to hear you expand on Kojève's later career. I really appreciated the sort of dissection of his slides, but I'm interested in his decision not to publish actually any of his work, the fact that in sort of this tremendous negativity towards his own philosophical projects. And I guess you already started to answer this in your discussion of his administrative bureaucratic life. But how do you interpret overall his activities? Was he an artist or a bureaucrat? What was his post-historical project for the rest of his life following the war and up until his death, incorporating all those different pieces of his activity?
I think, in fact, after all this said here about him, I think he thought that there is a kind of there is a kind of tension between, let's say, administration and democratization. He believed that our political world is defined by that, and he believed that democratization is dangerous because democratization leads to nationalism. Yeah, because the moment you begin to speak about demos, yeah, you try to define it, and at the moment you define it, you go into the idea of la nation, yeah, nationalism. So his idea was to find a balance between imperialism and nationalism. And that was Europe. Yeah? So he believes that there is a possibility to create, as I said, modern empire, which is European Union, that is liberal enough and open enough, administered Europe, but open enough so that in cultural and other aspects, individual states can decide, individual nations, individual ethnic and cultural groups, can decide how they live. Yeah? And so he believes that the model for this homogeneous and universal state should be a middle way between imperialism and democracy. And that EU is experimental model for finding such a middle. This idea very much guided his political activities, economic projects, and his polemics, yeah, with other European figures, political figures of that time. And I think that his practice, photographic practice, it also some kind of, how to say, imperial way of looking, universal imperial way of looking at the different national cultural identities or, I don't know, situations where his own Russia and France were the same level, China and Japan, so no difference, yeah. No privileges, yeah, everything, equidistance to everything.
I think we have time for one more question. Does anyone have one?
I was surprised to hear you describe his attitude towards the European Union as a kind of kind of imperialism or an empire. And so would he have made a distinction between federalism and imperialism? Because, I'll end here.
Yeah. He speaks about imperialism. Yeah, he speaks about empire. And he, of course, says that classical colonialism was domination of one nation over other nations. Yeah. And true empire is a non-national, transcultural, trans-state, yeah, administration that is built in a way that it doesn't create any preferences for any specific ethnicities or the cultural patterns. And he believes that EU can be such a neutral administration, yeah, that can create an administration where such different and conflicting countries like Germany and France, for example, yeah, could cooperate without dominating each other. Probably federalist is too close for him, probably. Yeah. Probably federalist is USA is federalist, but it's not the same, yeah. He didn't want to have some kind of strong federal government or something like that. He looked for a very loose but still controllable situation. Yeah. So to minimize the administration, but still to make administration more or less capable, yeah, to do what can be done only on this level. Yeah. You know, I think in a practical sense, he was like Catholic, yeah, subsidiarity. Yeah. So everything that can be done low level is done low level. On what is cannot be done low level, yeah, then it's delegate. I think that he was very much interested on the also in the medieval forms of government, of relationship between church and nation, and entities, feudal entities. So he was looking politically for something like a right balance. Is it possible to find the right balance? Is of course a big question. But if they ask what was his political goal, that was his political goal.